This is lecture number 4, and we're moving from the story of the children of Israel in bondage in Egypt. They've made their way through the wilderness, and we're going to pick up a few chapters in Joshua and a few more in Judges. This is the time for the people to come to the land and begin the fight to retake their land. Remember, there are a lot of other people there, and they've gone down to Egypt, so they have no control over that land, what we think of as the Holy Land, Land of Canaan. And then in Judges, they've controlled some of the land, but not all. And we're going to see some cyclical history going on there. So let's pick up Joshua 2. You may have heard this story before about Rahab and the spies. The people are coming into the land. You need to take a look at a map. They're not coming directly up the coast from Egypt and then going east and coming into the land from the east. Instead, they're approaching from the desert, from the wilderness, from the land of Moab and Edom. That's to the east of the Dead Sea, and they're coming up and then going west across the River Jordan. So the first big city they're going to come to, or the first city, I should say, I'm not sure about the size, is Jericho. And so they scout out the land. And you've probably heard the story here, the spies that come in and hide and look around, and Rahab hides her. Kind of interesting, it says Rahab, she may have been a prostitute. That's what most people think of, but my Bible says an alternate reading for what she is innkeeper. Well, that's quite a bit different, isn't it? So I'm not sure. But what I think is interesting, if you look at chapter 1, Joshua tells the people to be strong and to be courageous. This is verse 7. Go forward with a lot of power and strength because God's on your side. And then chapter 2 starts off, Joshua secretly sends 2 spies, secretly. And he says, go take a look. And so they do, and then they report back. So kind of odd, isn't it? Do you see a connection there? How is that possible? Chapter 1, he tells them to be strong and courageous. Chapter 2, he tells them to do this secretly. In fact, at the end of chapter 1, only be strong and courageous. Chapter 2, the very next verse says, secretly go into the land. So should they rely on their own tricks, their own strengths? Is that a clash or an argument here about practical living versus faith? Maybe so. If you know anything about Rahab, if you've heard of her before, it's not just this story. The genealogy in the New Testament says that Jesus comes from the line of Rahab. So there are several women in the line of Jesus, according to the genealogy that we see there. So they come up to the land and they come into Jericho. Jericho is, a lot of people say, maybe the most ancient city of all. And of course, we know the story about the walls coming down. We just don't know specifically what happened. We're just not sure. They've done some investigating, some archaeological digging. Some people say, oh, the walls look like there was some destruction and some damage there. And other people say, no, the walls were already down when Joshua came. And there's argument how big the town was. So we'll just leave all of that alone. They do mention the Ark of the Covenant as they march around the city with the Ark. And I just want to make sure you understood the Ark. Of course, you've heard of it, thanks to Raiders of the Lost Ark as well. It was a hugely important sacred object for the children. It was basically a box. An Ark is a box. It was made of acacia wood and had gold covering it. Had rings, 4 rings, 2 on each side, and you stuck poles through there and then lifted the poles. You weren't supposed to touch the Ark itself. Now, at the top is a flat surface called a mercy seat, and then the whole thing was about 4 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet, and up at the top on each edge were angels. And inside, of course, was what was important. There were the tablets of the Ten Commandments. There was manna, which is that miracle food that God provided for the people when they're in the wilderness, and the rod of Aaron, representing the priestly role that Aaron had. Sometime you can read about the Ark, go online, you'll find all sorts of rumors and stories and gossip, all sorts of things about where did the Ark end up. Now, the last we hear of it It was 586 BC. Nebuchadnezzar bringing the Babylonians in destroyed Jerusalem, and that's it. We don't know what happened to the ark. Was it hidden somewhere in Jerusalem to keep it from the Babylonians? Maybe. Was it taken out of the city and ended up somewhere else? There's all sorts of people that are reporting that they have it or they saw it. All the way down into Africa, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church says it has it, and it's under guard. There are even things like the Knights Templar figuring into this story, Shades of Dan Brown. But the Knights Templar supposedly took it to a cathedral in France. So who knows? If you've got a little spare time, go check it out for yourself. So there's the Ark, and there's Jericho, and in the rest of Joshua, we're going to get the story of the attacks, both north and south of Jericho, as they begin to spread out and try to take over the land from these Canaanites that inhabited it. And that, of course, is going to bring about something that I wanted to spend a couple of minutes on, which is the idea that the Old Testament God was compelling his people to commit genocide, to take these people out and kill them. And some people are just horrified by what appears to be genocide. Richard Dawkins, a well-known atheist who speaks out a lot on issues, said that the killing of the Canaanites was an act of ethnic cleansing. He said it was carried out with xenophobic relish. Xenophobic means fear of strangers. So he says these were bloodthirsty massacres. And you can see where he's getting this. If you look at Deuteronomy, for example, Deuteronomy 2, verse 34. So we captured all his cities at that time and utterly destroyed the men, women, and children of every city. We left no survivor. So people see words like that and the chill goes up and down their spines. They think of current slaughters that we've seen so many of in the 20th and 21st century. But I want you to think about this, though. There is more to the story, as is true so often. The Canaanites, first of all, we need to just talk for a second about what their culture was really like. There was true degradation. This was not genocide for no reason. And in fact, I don't think it really was genocide. We'll talk about that in a minute. But this is not just one group didn't really care for another group. There were certainly idolaters. They practiced incest. They practiced adultery, bestiality. Probably the thing that horrified the Israelites the most was child sacrifice. And apparently how that occurred was a Canaanite baby was placed on a red-hot idol to be burned alive to their gods. And there's still some of those sites that are left in the land today. Secondly, keep in mind that this is not a fear of strangers, right? Xenophobic relish. Remember, that's what Dawkins called it. That sounds like they just were frightened of somebody that was different than them. But think back to God's promise to Abraham. He said all the families of the earth would be blessed through Abraham. And we get all sorts of interesting stories in the Old Testament about good foreigners, Melchizedek, leaders of the Egyptians in Genesis 12, leaders of the Philistines in Genesis 20, the wife of Moses, she's a stranger. She's not part of the children of Israel. She was dark-skinned, apparently. Rahab, we just met Rahab. God also commands Israel to show concern for aliens who came among them. I can give you some verses if you care. You can look it up. Leviticus 19:34, Deuteronomy 10:18-19. According to Israelite civil law, the stranger who lived in Israel, catch this, had the same legal rights as a native Israelite. That's Leviticus 24:22. Well, here's part of this whole genocide issue. It sounds like utter slaughter, but if we read carefully the books of Joshua and Judges, it suggests that taking the land included more infiltration and internal struggle. For example, if you look at Judges 1, we're going to skip over here for just a second. Okay, Joshua, Judges 1, verse 1. And down to over to chapter 2, verse 5. It says they attack, they struck down people, they fought against them, people fled, it says. They attacked Jerusalem, they attacked Canaanites, they advanced against the other people, they're having Let's see, let me skip ahead here. The men of Judah attacked the Canaanites. It was called such and such. They took possession. But verse 19 of chapter 1, so we got all this attacking going on, but it says they were unable to drive the people from the plains because they had iron chariots. I want you to keep that in mind. We're going to come across it again. The Israelites are not the advanced civilization here. In fact, they're the backwoods guys. They're the yahoos of this thing. They didn't have iron chariots. And it says, verse 21, the Benjamites, that'd be one of the tribes, failed to dislodge the Jebusites living in Jerusalem. And it says, to this day, the Jebusites live there with the Benjamites. So whenever Judges was written, there were still these strangers living there. So we're going to see this again and again. Verse 27 of chapter 1, Manasseh didn't drive out the people. And it says, nor did, verse 29, Ephraim drive out the Canaanites. Verse 30, neither did Zebulun drive out the Canaanites, nor did Asher in verse 31, and it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. So what am I saying here is that this idea of genocide and utterly wiping out the people apparently didn't happen. It's a hit-and-miss kind of proposition. So the idea of an all-consuming Israelite army coming through just like fire and destroying everything in its path is not true. Now, there was military action. I'm not denying that. Something else I think we need to keep in mind when we're talking about this idea of slaughtering and killing all and wiping out the men and women and the children is something used in these old documents called hyperbole. We're going to come across that again when we look at the literature of the Bible later on this semester, but hyperbole, that's exaggeration for some kind of dramatic effect. So if we say, I cried all night. No, you probably really didn't cry for 8 straight hours. If you say, my brother drives me crazy. No, you're not crazy. You're not insane. But he may create a lot of problems for you. We see it all through the Bible, hyperbole. Well, let's take Deuteronomy. Remember I quoted from you before about how we slaughtered the men, the women, the children. But if you go to Deuteronomy 7, chapter 7, verses 3 to 5, here's what you hear. You shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. Now, if they've gone through and slaughtered everybody, why would you have to say that? Apparently, the sons are still around and the daughters are still around. Then you look at Judges 1:21, it says they didn't drive out the Canaanites and they lived near them. How about Joshua 11:22? It says there were no Anakim left in the land and that they're utterly destroyed. But later, Caleb wants to drive them out. So they hadn't been destroyed. Okay, so I've done some reading on this. That's why I'm spending some time. I want you to be fully aware of this. Something else to consider in this area of genocide or not is that the ones who were destroyed, according to people who've really studied this, and I'll be glad to tell you some of my documents that I have that you can look up for yourself. But for people who've studied this, the ones who were destroyed were political leaders and army combatants, not non-combatants. And in fact, the towns of Jericho and then Ai, those are the first two towns that are attacked, were considered military forts. They were not towns full of farmers and peaceful people. And something else, battles that were fought were often defensive in nature. The Israelites were attacked first. There are also verses that say the Israelites came into towns and gave people a chance to surrender before attacking them. Other verses talk about driving out the enemy, not destroying them. So that I'm spending time on that because it's a common misconception that these were just rampaging armies, and there's far more to it than that. Okay, that's Joshua. We're going to see this attempt to conquer the land that works in some cases and not so well in others. Let's turn to the book of Judges. I don't want you to think of Judges as you might today's language, somebody involved with law. A judge was a charismatic leader. All right, so can you think of that? These are tribes, right? These are tribes that were impressed with somebody who was charismatic and who could sway them and show the power that they had. And what we're going to discover here is what's called cyclical history. Cyclical history. And what that means is, again and again, Israel is going to go through a pattern. Israel will be looking good, or at least one area will be fine. They'll be attacked by some ruthless opponent, get squashed, cry out for help, and a charismatic person, a leader, a judge, will come along, lead them out of that difficulty, and once again they're fat and happy, and then they fall into another trap. So it's going to happen like that cyclically, again and again. You feel like you're just spinning around when you read the book of Judges. Now, the other thing about Judges to keep in mind is it doesn't appear to be moving forward in a linear, chronological fashion. You can kind of mix these stories up. They don't seem to matter in what order they come. Okay, well, let me take maybe three of the leaders here. One is Deborah. Why don't we take a look at the story of Deborah here. This is chapter 4 and 5. So chapter 4, we meet, look how it starts off. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So then they are thrown into an enemy's hands, it says. And what do they do in verse 3? It says, the Israelites cried to the Lord for help. And who comes on the scene at this time? Deborah, a prophetess. Now, all I can say is, in a male-dominated patriarchal society, to have a woman be your judge, to turn to a woman, to feel that this is the best that you've got, the most charismatic person that you have, really says something about her. Can you imagine what she must have been like? Again, use your imagination. Powerful, powerful woman. And so what's interesting here that we're going to come back to, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time right now, is that we get the prose account, the history, whatever you want to call it, the story of the struggle that she mounts against their oppressors in chapter 4. And then in chapter 5, we get the poetry looking back at this same event. So it's one event taken from two perspectives. One is from the more, what would you say, factual, prose-oriented approach, the literal approach. And then we get the song or the poem of Deborah in the next chapter. So I'm going to hold off on that for now. If you want, we can just take a second to go through 4, but Barak has come up against, he's going to be on Deborah's side. He's gone up against this bad guy named Sisera. And it says Sisera had 900 iron chariots in verse 13. I mean, that's like M1 tanks, right? These are like Abrams tanks to those poor Jewish people. And but after all, God's on their side. Verse 15, at Barak's advance, the Lord routed Sisera. And Sisera runs for his life. And he flees to the wrong place. He goes into a woman's tent, a wife, and is pleading for kindness, and he's exhausted. He falls asleep, and this woman, Jael is her name, she picks up, this is pretty gruesome, picks up a tent peg and a hammer and goes to this leader of the enemy while he's fast asleep and drives the peg through his temple into the ground, and he died there. And so she's quite a hero to the Jewish people. Well, that's it. That's that story. But we'll come back, as I said, and look at it from a poetic point of view, because you're going to see such a different way of approaching the same event. Let's continue with another judge that you probably have heard of, Gideon. This is chapter 6 and on. Look at how it starts. Again, the Israelites did evil, and for 7 years he gave them in the hands of the Midianites. Okay, they're pretty powerful people. And who's going to come along? Somebody named Gideon. But what I think is funny is how we first meet Gideon. Again, use your imagination. This is chapter 6, verse 11. And we meet Gideon. He is threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. Now, where do you normally thresh wheat? You thresh it outside so the wind can carry off the chaff, right? The hull, the part that you don't use. But he's having to do it inside, indoors, in a wine press, because he's hiding from the Midianites. And this guy is going to be their leader. Hard to believe, huh? Hail, Gideon. In fact, that's what we get, isn't it, in verse 12. The Lord is with you, mighty warrior. Can you imagine if Gideon's, I mean, just again, put yourself there. You're Gideon, you're hiding, you're looking out, trying to be real quiet about what you're doing, and an angel shows up and says, mighty warrior. My guess is Gideon looked around to say, who are you addressing? And Gideon, as a mighty warrior, is really, really tentative in this whole thing and has to have all sorts of proofs given to, you know, whether he's really going to win this thing or not. I want to show you something here that I think is funny. Verse 25 of chapter 6, God says to him, I want you to tear down an altar to Baal and an Asherah pole too, which is a symbol of the fertility goddess Asherah. So he's supposed to tear down these false idols, and he's supposed to build a proper kind of idol, of altar to God. So here's Gideon, right? Here's the mighty warrior. So you'd think he'd do this, and he'd stand forth and call for the people to come join him and take on these Midianites. Well, let's read the rest of this story here. Verse 28, in the morning, the men of town get up, and what do they discover? Baal's altar is smashed, and so is the Asherah pole. And they say, who did this? Now, isn't this the time? If you're the mighty warrior, you're Gideon, you step forward and you say, I did it. God is with us. Join me. We'll take on these Midianites and get rid of them. Well, so they had to go investigate, and they were told it was Gideon. So they demand of his father, verse 30, bring out your son. He must die. He's broken down all of these idols. He's done this terrible stuff. In verse 31, Joash says, it's a hostile crowd. He basically says, take a hike. Now think about this. The mighty warrior is where? He's inside the house, and his daddy is out speaking for him to protect him. Doesn't sound like a mighty warrior to me. So I love that scene. That strikes me again as a bit of humor in the story here. So he does eventually become a mighty warrior, and he leads the people. And of course, you may have heard of Gideon Bibles, and that's where they get the name Gideon. It has to do with how the little trick Gideon played to a little psychological warfare during the battle. But I'll let you read that. It's the rest of chapter 7. So if you've ever seen an image on the front of those Gideon Bibles that has a pot with a fire in it, that ties into the story here. So you can read that. How about one more famous judge? Let's skip ahead a few chapters here. Chapter 13, the birth of Samson. Wow. Well, there are a lot of jokes, a lot of stories about Samson, huh? I want you to think of this. I want you to think of Samson as a symbol of Israel as we go through this. Because he takes on these vows to be special, holy, set aside. Does that sound familiar? Isn't that what Israel is supposed to be? And what happens to him instead? He goes astray, doesn't he? If you know the story, he marries into the wrong type of people, and we get a lot of problems there. There's a lot that we could cover in the story of Samson here, but just I want you to keep in mind that what we have is a look at a person as a symbol of the entire nation. He starts off with such great promise and ends up in such a terrible situation because he's wandered from the faith and he hasn't taken his vows seriously. I wanted to look at something in particular. Chapter 14 has to do with riddles. Samson asks a riddle. It's kind of a cheesy riddle because I don't think anybody could have figured it out, but he is coaxed by a woman to give away the secret to the riddle. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, women are his downfall. But I like riddles. I think riddles are great because they are not just trivia questions. You don't have to be smart. You have to think about how language is being used. So, for example, here's one. What gets wetter and wetter the more it dries? Now, on the surface, it sounds like it's getting wetter and it's getting drier. How can that be? But the play or the word that is important here is dries. If something dries something else, it will become wetter, won't it? So the answer is what gets wetter and wetter the more it dries? A towel. How about this one? This is a bit of food here. See if you can figure it out. You throw away the outside and cook the inside. Then you eat the outside and throw away the inside. What did you just eat? Any ideas? An ear of corn. All right, so one more time, you throw away the outside and cook the inside. Then you eat the outside and you throw away that inside. So that's a good one. What can you catch but not throw? Well, catch is not the physical process of grabbing a ball out of the air. You can catch cold, So the answer is, what can you catch but not throw? A cold. Some others. How about this one? I have holes in my top and bottom, my left and right and in the middle, but I still hold water. What am I? A sponge. Give me food and I will live. Give me water and I will die. What am I? What things in this world is ruined by water? The answer is fire. Here's one that's pretty humorous. The man who invented it doesn't want it. The man who bought it doesn't need it. The man who needs it doesn't know it. What is it? Okay, one more time. The man who invented it doesn't want it. The man who bought it doesn't need it. The man who needs it doesn't know it. Answer? A coffin. Wow. Okay, what can run but never walks? Has a mouth but never talks? Has a head but never weeps? Has a bed but never sleeps? I like that one because it rhymes too. But think about running in a different concept of feet, a mouth, but not necessarily a mouth of an animal or anything. A head, but not a head like on top of a body. And it has a bed, but not a bed like you think of. So, what can run but never walks? Has a mouth but never talks? Has a head but never weeps? Has a bed but never sleeps? Answer, a river. How about, I'll just do one or two more. I never was, am always to be, no one ever saw me, nor ever will, and yet I am the confidence of all to live and breathe on this terrestrial ball. I never was, so never in the past, am always to be, right? So it's always in the future. No one ever saw me, nor ever will, and yet I am the confidence of all to live and breathe on this terrestrial ball. Answer, tomorrow. How about one last one here? What's this? The end of time and space, the beginning of every end, and the end of every place. Well, this one is I'll just read it one more time. The end of time and space. Don't think of real time and don't think of real space. Think of the words. The beginning of every end. Okay, again, think of the word end. And the end of every place. Think of the word place. So what is at the end of time and space? What's at the beginning of end? What's at the end of place? The letter E. Okay, so maybe that's a groaner. I don't know. I'll end at that point. But I love riddles. You can look them up. They're all over the place. So many different cultures have their own riddles. So we got the story of Samson. Just a terrible ending. You know the story of him with Delilah and the eventual downfall of him and clashing with the Philistines, and it's just mass chaos, and he finally dies. I wanted to mention, since we're talking Philistines anyway, I wanted to mention them. The Philistines were actually incredible people, and they've gotten a hugely bad rap, I guess you'd say, in the Bible. You read about the Philistines, and they're always the source of danger. They're always evil. They're where women lure good Israelites, and bad things always happen because of the Philistines. And so today, we think of them in a real negative sense. In fact, I looked up a dictionary definition of Philistines, and here's what it says: smug, ignorant people. Someone who lacks knowledge in a given area. Boorish, barbarous. Right? So that's how you think, oh, you Philistine, that's a put down. But what's interesting is if you took the Philistines and the Israelites and put them up against each other, the Philistines were the cultured people back then. It was the Israelites who were the barbaric ones. Remember, they're the ones that don't have the chariots. I forgot where it is. There's a verse that says the people would go down out of their hills down to the coast. That's where the Philistines live, along the coast there. Go down to pick up iron implements and all. That's where the high tech was. So this is not a case of the Israelites are sharp and they have their act together and the Philistines are a bunch of animals. It's the other way around. Okay, well, that takes us through at least some of the key things I wanted to focus on with the people coming into the land and beginning to fight and establish their tribes, and the tribes are scattered. The tribes are not successfully cleaning out the people there, and it's it's kind of a mess. And because of this, they're going to cry out eventually to get themselves a king. We'll see what happens when that occurs as we start to read the books of 1 and 2 Samuel next time.